February 22nd, House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. Present in the room, Vice Chair Olson, Representative Foster, Representative Thompson, Representative Keller, and myself, Bob Heron. If you have a cell phone, please turn it off. Okay, today we are going to take up two items. Hamilton Joint Resolution 15, supporting an Arctic caucus. And after that, we'll have a presentation from David Gottstein, getting Alaskans gas to Alaskans in the shortest amount of time while maximizing an export opportunity. Okay, we're joined by the famous Representative Chris Tuck. And as we've got musical chairs here, are my colleagues here on the right ready to roll? Okay. All right. Good morning. First thing I whip is House Joint Resolution 15. It's not my intent to pass this out today. We want to take more opportunity to visit with us as we gather information, and hopefully we'll have testimony after the bill will come up after. Okay, we're out taking an ease. Technical problem.
Sound check. Sound check. Check, check. 1, 2, 3.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. There's no delay.
So
it's recording.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, you ready to go, Deb? Yes. Okay. Okay, we're back on the record, 10:21. Apologize for that mechanical. House Joint Resolution 15, it's not my intent to pass it out today. We'll bring it back up after Energy Week, Energy Council Week. Representative Tuck, you have a question?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just making sure that we are on recording because I don't see the light coming on. I don't know if it's a fault with the light. I just want to make sure that everything is.
There is a faulty light right now.
So okay. All right. Just want to make sure.
We're out of, we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. It is 10:28. Sorry for those technical difficulties, and hopefully we're go through this. Now, getting back to where we were starting and stopping, House Joint Resolution 15, it's not my intent to pass it out today, but to bring it back before the committee after Energy Council week. So at this time, my staff will come forward. That'd be a small intro, and then a PowerPoint, and then up after Rob will be Matt Morrison, who's online. So at this time, state your name and affiliation for the record, and give us a short presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rob Earle, Staff Representative Heron. H.R. 15 encourages the Alaska Legislature to support the Arctic Caucus within the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, commonly known by its acronym PENWAR. Very briefly on PENWAR, we'll hear more later from CEO Matt Morrison. PENWAR was founded in 1991, and it's the only statutory, nonpartisan, binational public-private partnership in North America. It includes five U.S. states, three Canadian provinces, and two Canadian territories. PENWAR's mission is to increase the economic well-being and quality of life for all citizens of the region, and to coordinate provincial and state policies throughout the region, to identify and promote models of success, and to serve as a conduit for information exchange. Through facilitation of 18 working groups, PENWAR is able to tackle a wide range of issues. The Arctic Caucus is one such working group. First proposed by Senator McGuire in October 2009, the PENWAR Arctic Caucus was formed as an informal group of legislators, government officials, business and nonprofit leaders, all working to responsibly develop North America's Arctic. The Arctic Caucus's first open meeting was July 2010 during the annual PENWAR meeting in Calgary. Most recently, the group met in Barrow, December 1st through 3rd. The purpose of the group is to provide a forum within PENWAR for Alaska and Northwest Territories and the Yukon to discuss issues of mutual concern, share information, and identify areas for possible collaboration. You can see on pages 8 and 9 of the PENWAR handout, about 3 deep in your packet there, the action items that were agreed to in Barrow. One of these action items is to promote a pan-northern approach to federal government, and that action item includes this resolution. In fact, the resolution on page 2, line 28, states, the Arctic Caucus will also strive to promote a synchronized message detailing the common needs of the Arctic Caucus member regions to their respective federal governments and emphasizing that coordinated U.S.-Canadian federal policies are vital for the well-being of the region's citizens. And the resolution's final resolve calls on the governments of the Yukon and Northwest Territories to join Alaska in an enduring alliance to pursue the common goals of their regions. With that, Mr. Chairman, I have a brief PowerPoint.
Please go ahead.
Should be a color copy of this in your packets. It's a little bit of the population and a land area of the Arctic Caucus members. You can see that the Northwest Territories and the Yukon together are actually larger than Alaska, but that Alaska's population is about almost 10 times the collective population of those two territories. And here we can see a map of the Arctic Caucus. And just to give you an idea of the distance between the major cities in Alaska and the two territories. Just did a quick search for airfare if you wanted to visit one of these places from Anchorage in a random weekend in April. It's going to cost about $1,227 to fly from Anchorage to Whitehorse because you're routed through Seattle. And it's going to be another like $1,239, just a little bit more, even though it's more than twice as far to fly Anchorage Yellowknife. I think you're routed through Vancouver and Edmonton. And it's only, just as a side note, it's only $1,120 to fly from Anchorage to Istanbul, round trip. And driving distances from Anchorage to Whitehorse, a few of us have done that road trip. It's just about 700 miles from Anchorage to Inuvik. in Northwest Territories in the Arctic Ocean is almost 1,000 miles. From Anchorage to Yellowknife, and we had to confirm this figure with Ledge Research because we couldn't believe it at first blush, 2,227 miles, which is almost as far as Seattle. But on the positive note, from a short ferry ride, or a few-hour ferry ride from Juneau to Skagway, Skagway to White Horse is only 107 miles. Here you can see that the three regions have something in common. They have a dominant first city, especially in the Yukon, where the White Horse is two-thirds of the provinces of the territory's population. Seems to be something common in the north. You have a hub city like that. And here you can see that Northwest Territories does quite well in their per capita gross domestic product, perhaps partly due to diamond mines such as the one pictured that may be prone to flooding at times. I don't know. Taking a macro view at Arctic population, kind of the gist of this slide is that it's important for us to team up with our neighbors on this side of the Arctic Ocean because we are vastly outnumbered by the other side of the Arctic Ocean. And that second column on the right there is if there was 1,000 people in the Arctic, how many would be from each of those regions? You can see that almost half of the people living in the Arctic do so on Russian soil. And these numbers were taken from the table were taken from a UN nonprofit. It's interesting their definitions of the Arctic because they include all of Alaska, you can see there. Which, of course, includes Ketchikan at a latitude of 55 degrees, which is the same as Moscow, which obviously is not included in the numbers. But often Alaska is lumped together as a whole into Arctic discussions like this. And this just shows that we actually have a larger indigenous population than any other Arctic country living in the Arctic besides Canada and Greenland. And here's the two major Arctic sea routes that are being talked about due to decreasing sea ice. The Northern Sea Route goes over the top of Russia. The Northwest Passage goes over the top of Canada. And this is the Bering Strait. It saw 325 transits last year, which is about 2% of the traffic in the Panama Canal. But as you can see by this graph, it's increasing pretty dramatically in recent years. And this is the extended continental shelf claim under the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. A country can claim out to 200 miles or the edge of their continental shelf, whichever is further. So what that means for Alaska is you can see the yellow line down there, the arc, that's about 200 nautical miles. And since the continental shelf is so narrow most of the way there, that would be where the U.S. would claim, except over in this region, towards the border with Russia, the maritime border, the U.S. could if the Senate ever ratifies UNCLOS, the U.S. could make a claim out in that area as an extended continental shelf. This shows all the claims made to date, except the U.S.'s claim has just not actually been made. But you can see the light green there above Russia. That's what they're claiming all the way out the North Pole, based on the Lomonosov Ridge, which they claim comes out of the Eurasian landmass. So we'll see how that works out. Representative Tuck.
Go ahead, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, what does it take to make those claims? I mean, how is Russia able to make those claims so much quicker than everybody else, or do we know?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I think they can submit whatever kind of claim they want to the UN, and then the UN judges it. I'm not sure when that happens. But, yeah, I think they can claim whatever they want.
But the basis of their claim is that it's the extension of the continental shelf. And as you can see in the potential for us is that, you know, obviously we'd have good grounds if the UN recognizes the other countries' claims as well. So I think we're in excellent shape.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead and finish up the slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is the last slide. This just shows the Arctic management area, which is out to 200 miles, and that double hash on the right is a maritime border dispute between the U.S. and Canada. And the Canadians maintain that the maritime boundary is an extension of the land boundary, whereas the U.S. claims that the boundary should come perpendicular out from the coastline. So since the coastline on average is tilted to the northeast, we get this hash mark here for overlapping claims. And it's about the size, almost the size of New Jersey. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there any questions for the first presenter? Seeing none, thank you. Okay, we do have Matt Morrison online. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Pacific Northwest Economic Region. Matt, are you available?
I'm here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name, affiliation, and Rob will run the slides here, but begin your presentation after.
Excellent. Thank you. For the record, it's Matt Morrison, Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, and I'm here in Seattle online. So thank you, members of the committee. I'm sorry I'm not there in person, but delighted to be part of your meeting today. If we could go to the second slide, Rob. The Penwar is 20 years old, and I think, both Senator Dyson and Senator McGuire have served as president of Penwar. I think the point of the Arctic Caucus is really that the importance of relationships in accomplishing goals in the Arctic with the huge geography we're dealing with and developing capacity and demonstrating capability is best illustrated by expanding existing spheres of influence, and I think that's really the idea of this Arctic Caucus is the provincial and state efforts can be collaborated and have a greater voice in both Ottawa, Washington, D.C., and throughout the Arctic region. So as you see on this slide, these are the delegates in the current legislators of Penwar, and it does include the Northwest Territories as well as the Yukon. There on the map. Let's go to the next slide. Just an example of some of the ways that Penwar has been successful in expanding spheres of cooperation. In 07 at our Edmonton meeting, we had Secretary Chertoff and his counterpart, Minister Stockwell Day, and that was the genesis of the enhanced driver's license that made it into federal policy in a remarkably short time. Allowing states now to actually have driver's license that are provide the same credential as a passport in the region, and that took weekly conference calls, numerous visits to Ottawa and D.C. to push people along and make it happen before the Olympics. Our Legislative Energy Horizon Institute, we had four graduates last year, including Jean Terrio from Alaska. This was a binational effort with U.S. DOE partnering with Penwar and the Canadian provinces to have, which is now done a binational regional program for giving certificates in energy policy to state and provincial legislators. During the 2010 Olympics, we formed a border council, and this was especially supported by the state of Washington to really work on stakeholder border concerns prior to the Olympics. And because of that, we have had the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, Border Czar, Alan Burson, out here several times. We're in a very good position to work on the new Beyond Border Declaration that was given by President Obama and Prime Minister Harper on February 4, working on regulatory compliance issues and a host of perimeter security issues. Many of you know that we've taken legislators up to the oil sands several times, and I think more important on this bullet is an all-day private meeting that we held with Alberta's Royalty Review Team with just Alaska legislators back in 07. which several legislators from Alaska told me was, you know, probably one of the most important meetings they ever attended, because there's no other jurisdiction that has dealt with royalties like Alberta. Senator McGuire led the development of this Arctic Caucus in 2009, and along with a very strong support from Premier Floyd Rowland, who is from the Northwest Territories, and they co-chaired the meeting in this past meeting in 2010 in Calgary. And there's a great deal of interest in both the Yukon and Northwest Territories in working together with Alaska. They, like all of our states, feel that Ottawa doesn't listen to them, and they have a whole different opportunity in Ottawa by linking with Alaska. So it's a real plus to them. And I think we do in D.C. as well. And the last bullet on this slide is just we've worked on an international rail connection between B.C. and Oregon. And by pulling people together in a similar fashion on a corridor, really did contribute to Oregon and Washington getting $726 million in the last round of for rail infrastructure improvements. We also did support the Alaska or Yukon rail study that was done several years ago. Let's go to the next slide. The Arctic Caucus was founded, as I mentioned, in 2009. It's a forum for the northern jurisdictions, but not only the northern jurisdictions. There was a clear recognition that states and provinces are very central in many of the Arctic issues. So the ports in the state of Washington, the oil sands development in Alberta. Alberta is kind of the gateway into the Northwest Territories by road. So it's been led by Alaska, and there's been a very significant and very keen interest in this. And the first leadership forum was held this past December, 1-3 in Barrow. Next slide. The action items that were mentioned by Rob on page 8 and 9 of the handout really talk about this kind of advocacy from both the Canada and from Penwar and pushing the U.S. into the Arctic Council. We have several members of the State Department attended this meeting, and I'll be out with a number of you during the Energy Council meeting with the key person at the State Department on Arctic issues. Also to promote a northern approach, really looking at what we have in common to both federal governments. Next slide. We talked a lot about the AIS system to support better capacity for search and rescue, response capacity, and including joint training exercises. And clearly responding to life-threatening situations in the Arctic precludes borders. One has to look beyond borders. And, of course, promoting federal support of the Alaska-Canada Highway and Shacklack funding was an issue. Other issues identified, next slide, gas pipeline development, UN Convention on Law of the Sea, which has already been mentioned, energy development and transmission, joint tourism and marketing, training and workforce development. These are all areas that could be enhanced by this kind of cooperation. Supporting development of youth exchange programs, conducting an infrastructure gap analysis to provide justification for investment in future cross-border infrastructure. Next slide. The Arctic Caucus will meet at our annual summit in Portland, Oregon in July. That's 19-22. And a second leadership forum now has been scheduled for Yellowknife, August 18-19. We will be having meetings in Washington, D.C. and in Ottawa throughout the spring to look at pushing some of these action items in the U.S. federal government as well as Ottawa. And we're looking at further development to implement and support the Arctic Caucus initiatives. So that's my brief presentation. I'm happy to take any questions, and I'm just delighted for your leadership in developing HJR 15, and I would urge your support of it. Thank you.
Matt, I appreciate your presentation. Has the efforts by the legislature here in Alaska, have you got any blips on the radar from our colleagues across the border?
Yes. I have sent your resolution on to Yukon and Northwest Territories. I think there's very keen interest in joining into this in an official way and really for the long term. Both Yukon and Northwest Territories are keenly interested in this.
So, Matt, one follow-up question for me are they standing by to see where this resolution, if it makes it through both houses in Alaska, are they standing by, or are they doing their own efforts as well?
Well, they're not in session. Well, Yukon is in session. They're certainly keenly interested in if this is going to go forward in Alaska, but I think Jim Kenyon is mounting a similar resolution in Yukon. It's likely that both the Yukon and Northwest Territories will have an election in 2011, so that is an issue that they're looking at as well.
Okay. Any other questions for Matt? Representative Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mostly just wanted to say hi, Matt. I missed you coming up this year, as you typically do, and just for interest of the committee. Matt has some pretty fun and interesting roots in Alaska. You might want to ask him to tell you some stories if you ever get a chance to meet him. One of them is face-to-face with a black bear in Eagle River. Another one, he was in a 12-foot boat, and I watched I was in a place where I could watch the 12-foot boat, and I could watch the glacier, which was calving, and I would say a several hundred-foot-high chunk of ice dropped into the water and made a 12-foot swell, fortunately, not a breaker. And, he wrote it out. So, anyway, pick his brain sometime. That's just a tip of the iceberg, and just wanted to put a little interest in today's testimony and to say hi to Matt. And I really appreciate Penmore, by the way. I got to throw that in. It fills a place that is incredibly important. Our partnering with Canada is significant. United States developed with east-west infrastructure, whether you're talking power grids or roads or rail, and the same thing in Canada, east-west, and it really provides Alaska with an opportunity to link in with our neighbors here on really important economic issues. So I'm sold on Penoir, and appreciate your work, Matt.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, appreciate your testimony. We're going to move on to the next person to present to us. He's the managing director of the Institute of North. Now, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then, of course, you can explain why we have a new film crew in the room.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nils Andreasen. I'm the managing director at the Institute of the North. And just to speak directly to the film crew behind me, the Institute has brought a group of young Alaskans to the capital, many for the first time, to film a Young Alaskan's Guide to the Alaska State Legislature, a series of video tutorials that we can share with young Alaskans across the state. To the matter at hand, though, and HJR 15, as many of you know, the Institute of the North was founded to educate Alaskans about the reality, the richness, and responsibility of the North. This has meant that the Institute has taken a leadership role in providing opportunities for multiple stakeholders from across the Arctic to engage in circumpolar transportation, energy, and infrastructure issues. These opportunities are critical for Alaskans to engage in. The Institute continues to serve the state by connecting local, state, federal, and international actors to one another and these issues. Much of this has been done through Arctic Council initiatives, which we believe to be the proper international forum for addressing many technical, scientific, and human challenges. An important corollary to something like the Arctic Council would be a sub-regional forum such as the Penoir Arctic Caucus. In this respect, an Arctic Caucus provides multiple opportunities for the state to engage with its neighbors to articulate a pan-northern approach to infrastructure and policy development. But I take a few minutes today to emphasize the multiple drivers behind this conversation. I'm sure many of you know a lot about Arctic issues, and a lot of it having to do with change. Increasing change, while important, is not enough to prioritize Arctic policy and infrastructure. And more important is more information is needed to describe the interests and need that frame this issue. There are many factors that affect your decision-making ability. Energy and resource development are an example of this. Northern regions depend on the responsible management and development of their resources to sustain their people and ensure a vibrant economy. The expertise of other Arctic nations is instructive in this regard. Many of our neighbors share similar challenges. The resources developed off these coasts and on them will depend on their ability, too, to get to market. Another driver is the incredible natural beauty of our coastline and the tourism potential, as well as the choke point that is the Bering Strait, which Rob mentioned earlier. When we think of the position we are in relative to both the Northeast and Northwest passages, Alaska is in a critical position to respond to increased activity in the Arctic. The increase in Arctic tourism and other activity without the necessary infrastructure in place to support effective search and rescue and operations certainly highlights a challenge for the state, but it also reinforces our role in America's Arctic. Alaska must be in a position to respond to need in our waters and beyond. Infrastructure to support transportation activity is not only necessary, but necessary immediately. An aging icebreaker fleet and a Coast Guard base hours away from any disaster impacts our ability to respond when needed. From Kodiak to Point Barrow is a distance of 940 miles across three mountain ranges, about the same distance as Seattle to Los Angeles in the event of a disaster or other activity. Alaskans must think about our ability to respond, not only for our communities, but because we have a responsibility to be leaders in our region, our nation, and the international community. Alaskans must remind Washington that the U.S. is an Arctic nation because Alaska is an Arctic state. We must advocate for investment in critical transportation infrastructure. To do this, the state must participate in sub-regional and international forum to articulate our interests and needs. The Institute of the North has a long history of maintaining strong relationships with the Arctic Council and our region's neighbors. One reason we were in Barrow last December at the first at the leadership meeting of the Arctic Caucus. The state's partnerships are crucial to moving forward in today's world of mixed media messages and hypersensationalism. Reality is conveyed through thoughtful, intentional dialogue from technically sound and peer-reviewed deliberation. PennWARS Arctic Caucus provides an opportunity we need to produce relevant information to address critical issues facing the state and region. Alaska has a strong role to play in decisions affecting our northern waters. That role is strengthened when we work together. As an example of issues that Alaska should be watching, I would mention Arctic marine shipping and increased activity along our coast, as well as the Arctic Search and Rescue MOU that is being finalized by Arctic nations and should be coming out in May. At the same time, the Institute of the North recently convened the 2010 Arctic Aviation Experts Conference, which provided the only platform in the world for addressing Arctic aviation challenges and opportunities. We need to be in a better place to do more of these kinds of activities. If we're to take advantage of our assets, we can best do so by looking at developing strong relationships, both between sectors and with our neighbors. In all, transportation infrastructure development should address local needs while aligning with comprehensive national policies that reflect local decision-making ability. This should be done in the spirit of cooperation and interconnectedness that is the Arctic. U.S. Arctic policy should inform Alaska's decisions at the same time that Alaska educates federal policymakers as to our priorities and challenges and opportunities. It's worth examining as well the recent released Arctic policy of our neighbors, including Canada. Canada reaffirmed their commitment to the Arctic in August 2010, when it announced Canada's Arctic Foreign Policy Statement. The statement, much like ours, elaborates the international implementation of their northern strategy. It makes explicit Canada's commitment to working with international partners for the advancement of the region. This week, the Institute will be hosting the Arctic Policy Forum, and many neighbors from Canada and the chairman included will be presenting on many of these issues, which are more involved and complex than I have described here today. It's worth considering future opportunities for discussion that continue to strengthen our relationships, our learning together, and our collaboration as we address the many challenges and opportunities facing us. PennWire's Arctic Caucus provides exactly the forum the state needs to continue this conversation. I welcome any questions from the chair or committee, and thank you for your time.
Any questions? Seeing none, but I'll so the Arctic Policy Conference that's on Friday that you mentioned is, I guess, what would be, in your opinion, the highlight of that conference of the speakers that are coming?
Sure. I think the conference this Friday has to do with three priorities that came out of the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. Those are addressing the infrastructure deficit, looking at Arctic marine traffic systems, and one more. But I think the clear priority is in an infrastructure deficit, and I think that's the role that PennWire's Arctic Caucus is going to play an important part of in addressing. When you look at the gaps in our ability to respond off our coast, it's impressive as to what we're lacking. And our neighbors, both Yukon and Northwest Territories, recognize this. And many speakers, including some from Yukon, will be presenting and really looking forward to that exchange of information between colleagues.
All right. Seeing no other. Oh, Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
Debbie is, she came here several minutes ago. And Representative Miller is in the audience. And Bob, you're welcome to sit with us up here. Please come forward. Well, you can leave from the chair here, too. So, please go ahead, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I find all of this very exciting and intriguing. But I'm curious, for Canada, the Yukon Territory and Northwest Territory are participating, and yet clearly Canada has a bunch of other provinces that also are Arctic provinces. And do we know why they're not participating? Do we hope to entice them?
Sure. I think right now the three jurisdictions that are participating are, as you say, Alaska, Northwest Territories, and Yukon. The other territories are able to participate as well as the other states through PennWire. Mm-hmm. So each invited to the leadership forums and annual conferences that PennWire hosts, and that acts as a platform for all those stakeholders. I know that in Barrow, one of the things that we talked about was BC, Alberta, Seattle acting as gateways to the Arctic. Have to fly through them, it sounds like, to get to just about anywhere we want to go between jurisdictions. So all very involved and relevant.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gardner, when we were in Barrow, we did talk about Nunavut because that's the other territory that has the Arctic. And Northwest Territories indicated that they're very much interested, but probably not ready at this time, but mm-hmm. of course the provinces have a different relationship to Ottawa than the territories, and so I think the Arctic is the common denominator in this particular sub-caucus of PennWire.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question. You mentioned that about the gaps in response, search and rescue. What's the first step that needs to be taken in order to start to fix that problem? Is that something that we need to go to the federal government and work with the Coast Guard, or what can we do on our side?
Yeah. I think one of the recommendations that came out of the leadership forum in Barrow was an assessment of infrastructure in our territory, in Alaska and northern Canada, and really identifying – well, I guess two processes. One would be a benchmarking process. Where do we need to be? What size runway and lighting and infrastructure do we need at our airports? What ports do we need? And what depth do they need to be at to get response vehicles into? So I think doing that benchmarking piece and then the baseline assessment of what's there, I think that would be a crucial role for the state to take without relying necessarily on others, including the federal government. So certainly something we have the ability to do.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, sir. We have other people to testify, but there is at least a note, and I'll give this letter to Deb to read into the record, but the Lieutenant Governor, Mead Treadwell, has presented testimony, and I'll just paraphrase it. essentially he says that Alaska is an important part of our national security. The governor and the lieutenant governor appreciate us considering this resolution and think it's important as well. So we'll place this his letter in the record. So at this time, Mike O'Hare, are you online, sir?
Mr. Chairman, I am, sir.
Please state your name, your affiliation, and your brief testimony.
For the record, my name is Michael O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for the State of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, I'm here to answer any questions based upon existing arrangements, agreements for emergency management disaster preparedness. Very briefly, there are existing agreements, arrangements, advisory committees between the state of Alaska and Canada with regards to coordinated collaborative preparedness for emergency preparedness, response, and recovery issues. The state of Alaska's our responsibility is to make sure those communities are best prepared for any disaster and better prepared for any disaster. So I am available to answer any questions. Sir.
Okay, is there any questions from Homeland Security? Not going to ask you to comment, but just put it on the record. You guys have been in the news with one of our colleagues.
Sir, that's federal TSA. We are a state agency, but we're well aware of the news.
Nice step.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Foster, question to Mr. O'Hare.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I had an opportunity to sit down with Mr. O'Hare just recently, and they had responded to Savunga's issues in terms of power that was knocked out due to icing on power lines, which in turn caused the circulating pumps to go out, and then before you know it, the whole community had frozen pipes, and they responded to that, and just very interesting to hear the things that they do there. So I just wanted to comment that I thought they did a great job. Thank you.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. And seeing no other questions, we'll move on to the next person that signed up to testify. FYI, we do have Carrie Fisher, Division of Public Health, who's available for questions as well. So, Paul Foos, for the record, your name, your affiliation, and your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Foos, and I am president of the board of the Marine Exchange of Alaska. So, what I wanted to speak with, there are several references to vessel tracking here, and you heard about automated identification system. I just want to say that vessels in international trade have to carry transponders on board, and they're putting out the signal of where their vessel location is, but there was no one to receive that signal. So what we did with support of the U.S. Coast Guard, state funds, and private sector funds went out and put up an array of antennas in the Arctic and actually around the whole state to see what traffic was there. And it's just amazing. I mean, in our own mind, I've lived here my whole life, thought of it as kind of a quiet area up there, but the amount of vessel activity we're seeing now, even before opening of the Northern Sea Route or offshore oil development, is really incredible. So the purposes of it is Arctic domain awareness, knowing what's out there, and from that you can analyze that data to see the patterns of movement to set policy. Should there be set fairways? Should there be buffers away from whale zones or whatever? Then you can enforce that policy by seeing, okay, these people are following the regulations or not. And then if we get in an incident where we have a marine casualty, we can go in and do command and control of the assets. Where are the response vessels? Where's the equipment? What's the drift zone if you've had an oil spill or something like this? So. And if you'd like, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the next time you bring this up, I could ask our techs to put up a real-time display for you of how the system works and just what we're seeing in the Arctic. I want to speak in favor of this, of what you're doing here and all the work the Northern Waters Task Force and all this for the focus on the Arctic, because there are issues out there, U.S. Arctic policy, oceans policy, Law of the Sea Treaty, Endangered Species Act, risk assessment activities of the Bering Straits and Unimak Pass, that are overarching issues that are going to end up affecting our state as much as anything we're doing ourselves here. And these are national and international agreements that are going to be made that are going to have a lot to say about it. So it's really great to step out and do that. Institute of the North, they're also a great organization. They do have a capital budget request in to do that assessment that Representative Foster was talking about. It's in CAPSIS if you want to take a look at it. And I'll also be going up for the Arctic Policy Forum. And I think that probably the more correct answer to what was the most important highlight of this would have been Chairman Herron's presentation on the Northern Waters Task Force. I'm just kidding. But he will be there, and it is important, all the work that you're doing here. This is a direct tie to economic development. If we don't pay attention to these things, this stuff is going to come around, and it's going to come back and bite us if we're not part of it on the front end.
Just as a comment, thank you, Paul. Just for the comment is when we were in Barrow, was it Captain Page that was up there?
Yes, sir.
Of course, he alerted everybody to the incident of that freighter out on the chain, and he had real-time view on his iPhone. And we knew immediately when the signal came out that ship was in trouble, and then, of course, it was a successful rescue. So the exchange is extremely important to Alaska. Any questions for Paul? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, I believe that's all that is available to testify. So we're going to close this out and get ready for our next one. But the intent of the chair is to bring back this up by mid-March for passage out of this committee, the resolution. So we'll just take a brief at ease, and we'll have Mr. Gostin get set up. On the record, it is 11:11, and so Mr. Gostin, here's the plan: is normally we adjourn at 11:45, and I have a very important meeting with Representative Keller at 11:45 as well. But if we need to run over a few minutes, that's fine. But normally it's 11:45.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, to have the opportunity to share with you the complexity of the challenge that Alaska faces, and then the complexity of what we need to accomplish in order to overcome those. And my name is David Gostin. I'm a Chief Investment Officer and President of Dynamic Capital Management based in Anchorage, Alaska. I apologize, there's going to be a lot that I'm going to present to you today that has a lot of detail at it. But trust me on it, it's only scratching the surface. It really is a 30,000-foot overview. I want to also say that I'm independent. I'm not representing anybody. I'm not looking for a job, so I'm not. This isn't a precursor to get paid for anything. I'm not interested in running for political office. I'm not trying to grandstand or anything. I'm just a lifelong Alaskan who's very concerned about what the prospects are. I've handed out a couple of things today that aren't included in the presentation that I think are important to reference. So I want to do that. But I have some contextual things I want to just run by very quickly. One of the first is that Scott Goldsmith has issued an 18-page report recently outlining what he views as the fiscal challenge and opportunity for the state, and I was very concerned and skeptical about the conclusions that he reached, so I spent part of yesterday doing my own analysis. I'm a registered investment advisor, and one of the things I do for my clients is help them determine how much money they need at retirement to live the life they want, and what do they have to do between now and then to get there. So the analysis that I present to you today is not that far different than something that I do on an everyday basis. And just as a point of reference in terms of the challenge that we face, I want to describe this spreadsheet that I've put in front of you so that you can maybe appreciate in a broad context the challenge that we do face. And going down from the top left, we have assumptions, and the output is only as good as the assumptions, and I want to describe the assumptions a bit so you can understand the limitations of them. It's a population growth assumption of 1%, inflation of 2.5%, an oil flow annual decay of 4%, and I believe that might be a little generous, that it might be deeper than that, but I understand that's a state long-term number. An annual oil price rise of 5% that the Department of Revenue is also using, I think that's very ambitious. If you look at the far right-hand corner, that gets us to about $300 per barrel in 25 years. I don't think we'll get there. I think alternative forms of energy will come into fore if the price gets significantly above $100, which would suggest that the numbers that I'm going to present to you in this chart are optimistic. Then I have the current value, the permanent fund at roughly $39-40 billion, and then the budget reserve of $9.5 billion. And to the right of that, I went to the permanent fund's website yesterday, and I identified or detailed the different asset classes that they have the investments in and totaled them up. I have the percentage of the total that each one represents, and then an expected return from each of those asset classes after fees. And it may be a little more conservative than what some might ascribe. I do this for a living, and I believe that the world is extra challenged because of the extra debt loads on a global basis. So I think economic growth will be less than maybe what we've experienced as we've grown a few more gray hairs and less hair. And then the final column on the right is the attribution, and that's how we aggregate and average the composite of what those different asset class returns are. And so it basically estimates that the rate of return potential for the permanent fund and the budget reserve is at about 7%. So if we go down to the detail of the spreadsheet on the left-hand side, you'll see that we start off with a current state savings of roughly $49 billion. The next column to the right is the post-fee rate of return that we would apply to that. And then we have the column to the right of that, the state oil and revenue plus the other taxes and resources that we get. And that 1% growth is a function of a 5% annual oil price rise and a 4% decay. So it's one subtracted from the other. I think that's too high a number. As I said, I don't think the price of oil will rise as much, which further illustrates that these numbers may be optimistic. The column to the right of that is the state portion of the budget and its growth. A significant amount of our state budget is paid for by the federal government. And so if we grow that at a combination of the 1% population and inflation of 2.5%, that would represent a 3.5% growth rate. And then the difference between those two numbers is the surplus budget that we could put in the permanent fund. And you'll see not too long from now it starts to go negative. The number to the right of that would be the dividends paid after inflation proofing, and it doesn't include the calculus of the five-year moving average, so it's just a straight number in terms of what that is. And then the number to the right of that is the amount that we need for inflation proofing. So if you go back to the left-hand column again, you'll see that all our savings accounts under these scenarios go negative in 25 years. So we are a far shot from being able to be sustainable, and this is based on if we don't do something dramatic to change course. So I think it's very important to understand that, you know, for people in their 70s and 80s, this isn't crisis, but for people in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and even 50s, we are in effect in a crisis mode to a certain extent. So I just put that for you in terms of context. I also want to reference Roger Marks's report that was recently published out of the Federal Department of Gas Pipeline Coordination. I largely think that his assessment about a large capacity pipe is right on. It coincides with my thinking, but his use of the term subsidy is wholly not accurate. It's no more a subsidy than if when the permanent fund buys shares in Johnson & Johnson, that's not a subsidy. Let me please describe what a subsidy really means from a market perspective. Risk has to do with what you have the potential of losing, in an economic sense it means money. And so in a normal arm's length transaction where you have certain risks and rewards, you're trying to get a certain rate of return relative to the risk that you're absorbing. So for example, the risk of utility would be much less than a steel company, and you would want a higher rate of return for a steel company investment than a utility. And if through your arm's length transaction you're expecting or only need a return that would be less than a normal market return, that might be ascribed as a subsidy. But in terms of the opportunity for the state's involvement in gas pipeline, the returns are robust. They're so robust, they're greater than any individual investment one might make in any stock in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100. And these are calculations that I do on a daily basis. The return potential versus what we have to lose are enormous.
Mr. Gossian, for the record, Deb, to show Senator Pascavan, the co-chair of Senate Resources, in the room. And, Senator, you're welcome to sit up here next to your colleague from Fairbanks.
And quick question.
Before you continue, Mr. Gottstein, Representative Tuck, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, on the 5% annual oil price rise that the Department of Revenue is forecasting, do they forecast that over 25 years, or is it indefinite, or have they never come to a conclusion on that?
I made a couple of calls yesterday to some people here in the building that I had respect for and asked them what numbers were that the state was using. So it's garbage in, garbage out. If that's not a good number. But I think what it really saying is that even in a very optimistic sense, we're in trouble in 25 years. I think, you know, we're in trouble in less time than that. So I'm not really presenting these numbers to say this is an accurate. I just wanted to represent that from a ballpark point of view, we have a very serious challenge in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think AGEA isn't the problem. It's price. When AGEA was passed, the price of gas was much higher, and so I believe, as I'll describe, that AGEA may still be a vehicle that we may make use of. In terms of the tax structure and ACEs, the problem isn't what the oil companies are describing, and I will go into some detail in terms of how that relates to the pipeline, but there is a elegant solution to the somewhat aggressive nature of the progressivity of ACEs, and that is to reduce the level of growth of the progressivity instead of having it be a step function, have a decaying level of progressivity. So by way of example, for every dollar increase in the price of oil, instead of adding 0.4%, 0.4%, 0.4%, 0.4%, it could be 0.4%, 0.39%, 0.385%, and through mathematics, we can describe or arrive at a point where there's a choke point in terms of the additional gross margin that the oil companies achieve as the price rises, and we should be able to quantify and articulate what that would cost the state and determine what we would need in return in order to justify that. So I want to just have us recognize that it's part of the oil company business model to have us want to do things that are in their interest, and I'll go into a little bit more detail later. I am meeting with Tony Palmer tomorrow to describe in part what I'm describing to you today, and I will go further in terms of what that conversation will be. A couple weeks ago, I met with the president of Nova Gold, and also because I think the Donlin Creek project also plays an important role in terms of the potential uses of gas coming from a large capacity pipe in the North Slope, in addition to other mining operations and other value-added processors. There will be a FERC role, but a much lesser role than is customary for pipelines. One, this is an intrastate pipeline, but to the extent that we might build it for an export or out of Alaska capacity, FERC will want a role, but as I described, it will be a much lesser role based on the plan of finance that I've developed. So what I'd like to do is move forward with my presentation and start by saying that Alaska is headed for a long-term fiscal challenge and decay, as I've described. Our non-oil and gas-based economy is insufficient to sustain government. Our economy, absent our oil and gas and resources, will never have the capacity to be vibrant enough, big enough, and profitable enough that we could tax it enough to pay for state government. So it's our challenge to save enough of our natural resources in financial terms in our savings account to fill in that gap in perpetuity, including population and inflation growth. And that is what I was trying to describe in the chart that I presented to you. My goal is to describe a method to get Alaskans gas to Alaskans in as little as 6 to 8 years while maximizing the opportunity to gain efficiencies of economies of scale by having an export capacity pipe that will not only allow us to export natural resources to fill the piggy bank, but to transfer the value of lower cost energy to Alaska, to most Alaskans, through lower tariffs generated by economies of scale. And that is truly the only way that we can, in the end, provide a long-term lower cost structure for energy, which will have a dramatic impact also in terms of our ability to be competitive. So there are a number of contextual things that I think are important to discuss before I talk about the pipeline itself. And before I talk about the business of big oil, I want to talk about how Wall Street works, and certainly big oil is a part of that. I do detailed research on 40 industries. The oil industry is just one of those, and there are characteristics that are homogeneous to whatever industry that you follow. And there are three components that really drive Wall Street. The first is that, and I'm not being judgmental, I'm just describing reality. Some might view this as being an attack on Wall Street. You know, I work within the Wall Street environment. It's just the way it is. Surprise, surprise, there's checking and hockey. And that is that it is the combined goal of the board of directors and the executive teams they put in place to maximize the transfer of wealth from the corporations to their back pockets by the time they leave the company through salaries, bonuses, stock options, and other forms of compensation. We shouldn't be surprised or judgmental about that. That's why we want them there. If they do bad things, they should go to jail. But that's why they're there, so we should accept that. The second is that how they ostensibly gather those values to themselves is to create value for the shareholders by describing prospective earnings and cash flows and determine what price they can afford to pay for those future earnings and cash flow that gets them a return based on that risk profile. That's what I do in terms of being a stock picker. And then the final leg is that it's their job to get others to take the risk and for them to get the reward. And I know many of you who've been active in the stock market and other markets over the last few years have felt that pain, so that shouldn't be a surprise to you. So in terms of how big oil operates, you know, when we were young, we learned that movie theaters made their money selling popcorn, not tickets. And likewise, if you think that the oil companies make their money in the production, transportation, refining, and marketing of hydrocarbons, you would be equally wrong in that conclusion. Those are things they can largely outsource. They do those things when there are value-added gross margins relative to their main business, and they largely outsource that. That's why there are the Schlumbergers, Halliburtons, and so forth in the world. It's a three-step process for them to generate the vast majorities of the gross margins that they accumulate. The first is they accumulate the rights to resources in the first place. And when they sign a lease, we think it's an obligation, but for them it isn't. It's the first of many costs of an option in terms of getting those rights because they can walk away any time. And so that's phase one, getting the rights to the resource as cheaply as they can. The second phase is the cultivation of those resources, maintaining those rights, and keeping their cost of goods low. And in our environment, in selling the resource, we use taxes as a misnomer in terms of thinking that we're taking something away from them. But in our Constitution, we're required to sell the resource and get a return on it, and it simply is the mechanism that we charge in terms of price. And it's our challenge and responsibility to understand what is a rational price. And in the private sector, the price that one charges for their product is perhaps the most important decision they make. If you raise your price 10% and you lose 5% of your customers, your money ahead. If you raise your price 10% and you lose 15% of your customers, your money behind. And so it's the responsibility of the state to be sensitive about where that cusp is or that break point is. We want the oil companies to do our bidding for us. We don't want state employees welding and doing drilling muds. And it is in our interest to keep the resource in the ground traditionally until the price gets high or higher enough to get returns. And the oil companies are our agent in determining that. And then we share in the fruits of that bounty. The challenge that we have is we need some of the gas today for a variety of reasons. So we have a conundrum. But I also think it's very, very important to recognize in part of their goal to maximize shareholder value that there are only four venues where the oil industry or the insurance industry or the pharmaceutical or any of these industries have a duty to be honest and forthright and tell the truth. The first is under oath in a court of law. The second is under oath in front of legislatures and Congress. The third is in their tax filings, and the fourth is in their Securities and Exchange Commission filings. Other than that, they have no responsibility to be more honest than you are when you're at the Christmas table and your aunt hands you a fruitcake and she asks you how good it is and you say it tastes great. And that's the God's honest truth. I'm sorry, there is checking in hockey. And so the challenge that the state faces today is that we traditionally build a pipeline in how I refer the business model as a fillet and then build a business model. And the following set of alignments need to be in place in order for a gas pipeline or other projects such as that is to move forward. And bear with me for a moment, but this is the nature of the beast. And that is that you have to combine enough proven reserves with enough bona fide demand from creditworthy purchasers like utilities and value-added processors, whose credit standing is of a stature that defined benefit pension plans can buy those bonds with a certainty that their monthly pensioners will get paid. That's the level that you must achieve in the financial markets to attract purchasers on an investment-grade basis. And the volume of gas in the open season commitments must be of a high enough quantity to justify a large enough pipe that generates enough economies of scale, that generates a low enough tariff that makes the purchase price competitive for the purchaser and the wellhead value high enough for the producers not only to recover their costs of production, but to get an adequate return relative to the risk that I talked about before. And we have many sets of data points to suggest that the price of gas needs to be between $6 and $7 per MCF for that alignment to take place. We have the oil companies referencing it. We have the Canadian government about a month ago issuing permits to the McKenzie project, saying it's okay from a permitting point of view, but they recognize that it's not going to happen in the next 20 years because the price of gas isn't, guess what, between $6 and $7 per million cubic feet of gas. We have our own Federal Energy Department taking it off their long-range forecast because, guess what, the price of gas isn't high enough. So that's why I say a G is not the problem. It's the price that's the problem. And so the very, very important thing to recognize is that the board of directors, even though they will spend millions and millions of dollars on these options in order to get, garner, and maintain rights, they won't even spend the amount of money that it took to put the ink on this piece of paper on an agenda to deploy the capital for these capital-intensive projects until after the price of gas is above $6 or $7 per MCF for a sustainable period of time, and their internal forecasters predict it to be so over the life of the project 70 to 80% of the time. End of story. There's no project. Okay? Everything the oil companies are doing today is posturing in the phase two of maintaining that option and keeping the cost of goods as low as they can by baiting us into thinking that if we give them billions of dollars of tax relief, it will change the economics. And only if we give them enough tax relief where, in effect, we pay for the pipe and they own it and they get enough gross margin as if the price were $6 to $7 per MCF, will it induce them to take an active role in the gas pipeline. So it is critically important that we are waiting for Godot if we're waiting for the private sector on its own to build a gas pipeline. So as we move forward, we have this huge dilemma, and that is that we have serious, serious problems in the interior of Alaska, and they're coming to South Central as well. So from a baseline point of economics, it's important to recognize that the state of Alaska makes its money selling popcorn, okay, and that we make our money selling the resource, and that we don't need a return on a toll-rolled pipeline. And I'm not suggesting what I'm about to say as what we should do. I'm just describing it as a critically important baseline set of economics. The state of Alaska, because we make our money selling the resource, could write a check for cash, $8 to $10 billion, have the conditioning plants built, have the pipeline built to the interior, charge nothing in tariff, and make tens of billions of dollars on the gross margin of selling the resource. If all we did was increase our gross margin or revenue to the state by $500 million in a combined revenue from both oil and gas, and I'll describe how we invigorate that, that's a 5% return, more than we get in the bond market in the permanent fund. And so that's just part of an inkling in terms of how robust what I'm about to describe is worth it to the state. And so, again, the state doesn't need any tariffs, and what it does for us is puts us in a very, very powerful position. It means that we can offer tariff discounts to the market to reduce the price in order to induce demand. Okay, that's a very powerful position for us to be in, and I'll describe later in this plan of finance that I'm about to show you why that's so important. The risks of not doing something are huge. The risks that it will take in order to progress this project are very small relative to the risks at hand. Another baseline set of economics is marginal costs versus marginal returns. And so we have so much more to gain versus what we have to risk by moving forward. So what are our options today? We can do nothing and import LNG. And that's going to be the right answer until we have a good long-term solution. We don't want to lock ourselves into a long-term problem. We could build a bullet line, which for me would be a path to poverty. The second handout that I gave you today, I'm sorry that I kind of drew it up, but I wanted to kind of describe. And the line, the dotted line that you have represents perhaps the cost of energy that the interior Fairbanks might have been able to enjoy had things not risen so much over the last few years. And so many have been talking about a bullet line as a way to get past that. But a bullet line is a very inefficient transportation network. The economics of a pipeline is the throughput over time per pound of steel you lay. And as you increase the circumference of the pipe, you dramatically improve the quotient of economies of scale. A bullet line might incur a tariff of $8 to $10 or $11 per million cubic feet of gas just in transportation costs, and would lock the builder and the users of the gas at the other end to very high costs over a long period of time. And that would be cutting our nose off to spite our face. It would be worth more for the residents, perhaps with state assistance, to even pay more money in the short run to be able to wait until we fill a gas pipeline and get lower tariffs and pass those savings. And the amount of savings that we would be able to generate once we start to fill that pipe are dramatically overwhelm the additional costs that might be incurred in the short run. So, again, from a marginal cost and a marginal revenue point of view, the first sheet I showed you that we're in trouble. If we solve the problem with a bullet line, increase the trajectory to poverty at a much quicker rate. The third option is to wait for the price to rise, which is kind of what the oil companies want us to do. And the fourth thing would be for the state to take a role in building the pipe. And I'll go through that for you. And the goal that I'm wanting to describe is to have the state do the least necessary to ensure a large export capacity pipe gets built from the North Slope to the interior in the shortest amount of time, so that if and when other markets come to fruition, we have an efficient footprint in order to deliver it, which will help fill the piggy bank, but will also allow us to transfer those economy of scale values to most of the residents of the state, even out into rural Alaska, as a result of it, and do it in a way that does not compete with the private sector at all. And so what I'm describing is not to say that this is a pipeline to nowhere. It's to have the state take a role to get it to a hub. And in the meantime, if South Central and other parts of the state are importing LNG, then when this hub is announced, the rest of the consuming markets will recognize it will be their lowest cost option to do what they can working with the private sector to hook up to that hub in the shortest amount of time. So kind of like the Transcontinental Railroad connecting together, I can bet you dollars to no-nets the day that the state announces that this project would be moving forward, that Fairbanksons would be getting ready to build a pipe to connect to it, and they'll be there before the pipe gets down from the North Slope. I wouldn't be surprised if South Central is ready for it before that. So I'm really just trying to describe the role that the state can and must take that the private sector can't, and that is to incubate the largely empty portion of a pipe for as long as it needs to be empty so that we get Alaskans gas to Alaskans in the shortest amount of time. So there's a multi-step process in order to accomplish that. First, the administration renegotiates the license with TransCanada, which a G allows us to do. Tomorrow I'm going to give Tony Palmer some bad news. He's going to lose the license because the project's uneconomic unless he allows the state to renegotiate on this portion of the pipe in a public-private sector partnership and do away with the treble damages and all the other stuff that may, that hamper it. Other than that, he's going to be out of luck. He's going to be out of business in terms of building pipe. And so we need to build this and get this to a logistical sweet spot near Fairbanks. So once we do this, the state announces that it's co-sponsoring an export pre-build segment to Fairbanks, bringing the project to investment-grade status. And I'm not talking about the state designing, building, maintaining, or operating the pipe. Ostensibly, TransCanada can do. What the state would be doing is taking a financial interest by bringing the full faith and credit of the state to guarantee the loans in exchange for the capacity rights, which it immediately starts to sell into the market at a rate that the market has capacity to absorb. So it invites the sponsoring group invites the private sector to participate in it, with the state only keeping those speculative tariff rights that the private sector can't absorb. The rights to capacity equals rights to tariff. That's the economic value that the state is garnering. And so how do we do this? We do it in a kind of a financial engineering way, and that's what I do for a living. So I'm sorry, but I can't solve a very complex problem simply, and I'm not even going to be able to peel the onion back, because there are a lot of very complex issues that would have to be included in an offering that I'm about to describe. But I can assure you it's eminently economic, or vastly economic, and eminently financeable. The only challenge is politics. So what I have depicted for you is a variety of circles representing different owners at different times of the capacity rights. So immediately, once the state cuts a deal for in exchange of the loan guarantees for the capacity rights, and let's just say for argument's sake that just to make the number easy that it's $10 billion. It's probably less for the conditioning plants and the pipe to the interior, that it makes it investment grade, but immediately it cuts a deal with all the in-state utilities to take perhaps 5% of that capacity instead of the in-state users sending money south for importing LNG. Now it's helping the state pay off the loans. Now remember, the state can write the check for $10 billion and not get any of it back, and we're going to be okay. But we're going to get the private sector to bid in an auction process to whatever extent possible that they can absorb. So if you think about it, where the state owns the capacity, you know, a developer builds a shopping center, encumbers itself with a loan, and then starts to get tenants to give it money to pay off the loans. Okay, and then another important dynamic is we'll be auctioning off different capacity rights. So let's say it's 1% increments. So company A might bid X amount for the capacity at 20%, and it only gets paid once that 20% of the pipe gets filled. Somebody else might own the 21st capacity, then they get paid. And so as you get further out in capacity, the tariffs become less valuable, and the bidder will bid less for it. But they're not worth nothing. It's like you own a piece of property 5 miles from town, and the town's growing a mile a year. Well, that property is worth more than the land 10 miles away. But in 5 years, that land that was 10 miles away is now worth more. Okay, so the center circle represents perhaps 5% of the capacity that would be used immediately once the pipe is done. And who owns those capacity rights? The state owns it initially and then immediately sells them to utilities, the pipeline companies, the oil companies. That's investment grade. We already have firm commitments to be shipping gas right away. So it's not something that the state needs to retain. Okay. And so as you get further out in time, because there's more uncertainty in time, price, and volume, those capacity rights become less certain and therefore more risky. So that second circle represents a little different set of owners. The utilities have stepped out. They've already satisfied their ratepayers, so they don't need to participate in owning any capacity beyond the need to serve their own customers. The pipeline companies will own enough capacity to the extent it's investment grade. Now, there are two pieces that are important. Remember I said that we can lower tariffs to induce demand. We get on a plane. We go to Hawaii. We cut them a deal. We make sure that our North Slope gas is their cheapest alternative for the 21st century.
And in the private sector, what you would do is you determine what their cost is going to be if they maintain the status quo or their best option, and then we just price the tariff such that we're making our gas cheaper. Okay, so that's how you induce demand. So maybe we've already sold 5% capacity to ourselves, we sell 15% capacity to Hawaiians, but we only charge them 10. We give them a price discount. We didn't need any, we already have 15. Okay, so to that extent, the pipeline owner will still be interested in owning because they're pay-me-now kind of people. Their shareholders are dividend receivers. They don't have capacity to wait for the market to come to them. Okay, I had lunch with the president of Nova Gold a couple of weeks ago. I went to elementary, junior high, and high school with him, and I was talking to him about the potential of bringing a pipe from Fairbanks to Donlin Creek and help increase the capacity. Well, the bad news is, he said, well, you know, I've got $40 billion of gold in the ground there, and I've already done the land assessment, and I'd waste 2 years if I started that work. But ultimately, we were very happy at the end of the discussion when I said, well, you know, the state helps bring it to a hub, and then the other utilities help bring it down to South Central. We loop it to Beluga, and you're up to Donlin Creek. And I asked him, well, what is your fuel cost of production at Donlin Creek using diesel? He says it's about 25%. If he imports LNG, he's going to reduce that by about 25%. But once we bring it down from North Slope and back up, he's reduced it by 50%. So he'll be importing LNG for as long as South Central imports LNG. And as soon as South Central starts using North Slope gas, he's using North Slope gas. We've got propane on the Cusco and Yukon River. This is how we generate economies of scale and then start delivering these lower-cost energy solutions throughout much of Alaska. So,
Mr. Gutstein,
yes.
Just to keep you aware of the clock, is I'm probably going to lose all my members here.
I've got about 5 minutes to finish this piece. Is that okay?
Yeah, and then because between now and 12, which is 15 minutes, you're going to lose us all.
So. I'm very, you know, there's more after. I mean, I apologize. You know, this is by a factor of 100 more important than anything else you're going to do today.
No, I understand that, but you know, we've all made commitments.
No, I understand, yeah. So I'll be available, but yeah. But so let me just, if I could finish this.
Yeah,
this,
you bet. Go ahead.
Okay, so so the oil companies will have a limited capacity to incubate, but they'll still own enough capacity to reserve enough space for them to move gas that they want to at some point in the future, so they don't have to come back in and bid later. But at some point, they'll exhaust their capacity. And again, we have these 1% increments that we're putting out to bid. So as they step out, who steps in? Hedge funds, private equity, sovereign wealth funds. These tariffs aren't worth nothing. So just as I mentioned before, they'll bid on these rights to future economic values. And I wouldn't sell the last 1% for $1. It's too cheap. There should be a minimum bid that we would ascribe to each percent of capacity, right? And the two economic forces at play in determining this, and this is one of the very detailed complexities that is going to require a lot of work, is, again, as you get out in terms of the capacity rights, the values become less, but that last inch of steel is the most valuable because it increases the capacity the most. So to whatever extent the private sector can't bid up to that value, the state retains it. And so that last circle is the only piece the state keeps. So it takes the least amount of risk necessary to ensure the pipe gets built in the shortest amount of time in a way that does not compete with the private sector. So let me just quickly go through what we get for all this. We avoid saddling Alaskans with high energy costs for possibly decades. We avoid putting an export project at materially greater risk in terms of time, money, by moving from a highly inefficient logistical footprint to a highly efficient one. We get Alaskans gas to Alaskans in as little as 6 to 8 years. We put our future and destiny on our time frame by announcing to the energy community that we are prepared now to build, and we invite them to participate. We force them to act for fear of being left behind. We greatly reinvigorate the potential for adding volumes of not only gas but oil to the pipeline. When we have two pipes that aren't full, we have open season every day because any new explorer will know that if they find oil or gas, they have a place to put it. We take a huge risk component out of the whole exploration process. For the first time, the Oil and Gas Commission will be able to do its mandate of arbitraging the value between the value of gas and oil and knowing when it's more valuable to reinject gas. But when gas becomes more expensive, we ought to be reinjecting seawater or CO2. We position many parts of rural Alaska to potentially benefit from this. We get to Hawaii. We jumpstart the economy for decades. To a considerable degree, we avoid exposing the state to this long-term fiscal decay. If we have buyers and a pipeline, producers will have no choice but to supply gas. And let me just finally close in terms of the tariffs. The discussion about what we charge in tariffs is not only a critically important thing, but also a complex thing. From an economist's point of view, recognizing that we want to minimize, in a sense, the investment by the state versus the private sector, we might charge the ratepayers what they would otherwise be charged if they were importing LNG, and then as the pipe gets filled, reduce the tariff. On the other way, it's a public policy discussion. You may want to charge a tariff as if the pipe were full. Okay, my preferred choice would be to give the utilities direct rate relief that they can pass on a dollar-for-dollar basis to the ratepayers, because it takes about $1.25 in wages to be able to pay a dollar of energy costs. So if we reduce their energy costs by a dollar, that's the equivalent of making $1.25. If we were to reduce the tariff, it would raise the wellhead value, which would be good. But on the other hand, the oil companies would have to share that. So we'd have to raise our taxes to kind of get back to the equivalent basis. So, Mr. Chair, I think that's all as much as I could put in the thimble today, and I'd be happy to.
Well, Mr. Gassian, I appreciate it, and I apologize that we don't have more time. But I guess two questions. First one is, why would Mr. Palmer of TransCanada entertain a conversation with you?
Why would he?
You said you are going to meet with him, but my question is, why would he entertain a conversation with you?
I was a supporter of the AGIA process because an independent pipeline company has a lot more economic alignment with the state versus a producer pipeline. An independent pipeline company, the more product through the pipe, the more money they make, which is in our interest. A producer wants to limit the product through the pipe because it reduces their margins by having competing product at the point of purchase, unless they can have a high enough tariff to kind of squeeze that extra margin. And so he's recognized that I've been both an activist in terms of Alaskan politics for a very long time, and that I was a supporter of the AG process. And so he's been paying attention. And
well, good for you. The final question that I have is, of course, you went to the senator's community, and maybe briefly, what was the reaction to your presentations in Fairbanks?
It depends on who you talk to. But I think, generally speaking, for those who have the time to listen, it's very positive. And I've met with all our congressional delegation, Representatives Young and Senators Murkowski and Begich. I'm not suggesting that we should just go do this. What I'm really asking is that this be vetted to the same level that anything else is being considered, and that's what that they're also going to be suggesting. And I'm talking to as many people as I can to help people understand not only the huge challenge that we have, but also the huge opportunity we have if we take control of our own destiny. We are heading for a train wreck unless we do this, I'm afraid. Now, there may be another option, but the key thing is that unless the state takes the incubation risk of this last ring, which is the key to unlock Fort Knox, unless we do this thing specifically, we're heading for a train wreck. If we take that portion of the risk, there's peace and prosperity probably for decades to come.
Are there questions from committee members? For the record, Representative Kawasaki joins us in the audience. Sir, appreciate your tenacity and probably, being politicians we are, we're probably going to skim a couple ideas out off of this so that we can use them in the vehicle that's being debated now in the legislature.
You fire it well.
All right. Thank you, sir. It is 11:54. We're adjourned. Thank you.